Balance your trading strategy by adding futures. CME Group helps you manage risk and capture opportunities in all market environments. Capitalize on around-the-clock access to highly liquid global futures and options market across all major asset classes. Just visit your online broker and get started. Plug into valuable educational materials and trading tools and see what adding futures can do for you at cmegroup.com/onthetape.
All right, welcome to Market Call. It is April 15th. It is a Monday, a very special Market Call. I have my good friend, Peter Buchvar. He is from the Bleakley Financial Group. You guys probably know him on the Twitter. He's a CNBC contributor, and he also writes the Book Report, a little play on words. It's spelled like your name. It's one of my first reads every morning, people, so check that out. On the line there, great read. And Peter, you're doing work all day long and pumping it out on the Book Report. So thanks for being here, buddy.
Thanks, Dan. Great to be here and looking forward to chatting about the world.
I know the first time you came on with us on the tape, you were an early guest. This is back in 2021. And you said first time, long time. And I know that you listen to our stuff. So we really appreciate that. You guys also know that we give Peter a lot of shout outs here. Listen, guy is out this week here. We got Carter Braxtonworth doing extra duty for us Tuesday and Thursday. Liz will be with us on Wednesday. And if you haven't looked at the ESPN.com and Guy, you know, is usually keeping you up to date. The Rangers beat your Islanders on Saturday in a shootout. The Knicks got the number two seed, which he must be excited about. The Yankees keep rolling on. So Guy Adami, you're in Ireland, but there's your little update. All right, Peter, let's get to it, because Friday afternoon, I was not looking at the markets. I was indisposed here. I was at the Masters, by the way, and you cannot have a phone on the course. So I was very lucky to be there for that. But things were kind of melting down. The VIX was shooting up. The dollar was moving higher. Yields were moving higher. Gold and silver were moving higher. Oil was moving higher. There's lots of fears about what was going to happen over the weekend with Iran and Israel. Thank goodness, it was thwarted, the attack. Interesting that the Iranians were like, okay, that was our response. Hopefully calmer heads prevail and we don't see that escalated. The market today opened up. The S&P was up 80 basis points on the opening. Here we are. It's down on the day. So let's just talk about a little bit about how you think the market is what is it reacting to right now? Earnings season got going. The other thing is, and we're going to talk about financials too, you know, JP Morgan down 6.5%. When I saw that, okay, coming out and turning my phone on, I can't remember the last time I saw JP Morgan down 6% in a non-crisis mode.
Yeah, that was pretty rare. Now, granted, going in, JP Morgan was by far the best performing yes. bank outside of Citi. Citi finally got some life yep. Over the past couple of months. But I think when you reach the valuation that JP Morgan hit, there was no room for error. Mm-hmm. They didn't expand their net interest guidance, mm-hmm. Basically. And banks are in the business to lend mm-hmm. outside of their capital markets business, and there's very little loan growth. So you wonder, okay, what's the growth? I mean, if you look at the earnings estimates for this year
yeah.
for JP Morgan,
they're down.
For Wells, for Bank of America, there is no growth. Yep. To slightly lower for 2024. And even the estimates for 2025, which I usually fade because God knows how this year is going to finish, yeah. let alone next year, there's very little growth in that sector right now.
Yeah, you can make that argument for a bunch of sectors. I want them to throw a trend line from the October lows, okay? Throw a 50-day and a 200-day on this chart. So this is these come from our fine sponsor over there at FactSet. This is how easy it is to do this, people. And one of the reasons why we kind of look at these lines here, also throw a horizontal line at that $160 level. I mean, you know, this thing had already started to kind of roll over a little bit, Peter, you know, into that print. It was sitting right on that uptrend. And just to be clear, people, the low in late October, I think it was like $136, got to just over $200. So you talk to me in a year, if you don't have expanding earnings growth, and that was baked into the cake going into the print, you know, how do you have that sort of multiple expansion on a year over year decline in earnings?
Well, what I find interesting is that when you look at the banking sector, a couple of years ago, people said the Fed raising interest rates will help bank earnings.
Yes.
And they benefited from that.
Yeah.
I think now we've reached a point where interest rates staying higher for longer is now a negative because they're getting it hit on the higher deposit costs that they're having to pay out and crimping their net interest yeah. margin. So ironically, it's the banks that actually need lower Fed funds rate to get a kickstart to growth, both on relieving themselves on their rising deposit costs, but also lowering the cost of capital that could regenerate loan growth. Mm-hmm. Because yes, they're not lending, but there's very muted loan demand as well, because businesses and consumers are very sensitive to this high cost of money right now.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. And you know, I'll just say this, I mentioned this a few times over the last few months. It's like the narrative, you know, for banks was like, well, you know, last fall is that they need rates to go lower because these mark-to-market held to maturity books, you know what I mean, are just kind of killing them on a mark-to-market basis, right? But that's limiting their ability to make new loans and do a whole host of other things and the like here. And then when rates were going back higher, they're like, oh, it's good. It's good for net interest margins and the like here. Well, it'll be interesting to see as we get deeper into earnings season with some of these financials and specifically these money center banks, how they react. We'll spend some more time on the financials. I just want to quickly hit the rundown here. Listen, people, I want to tell you, because we have Peter here in the studio, if you have your toughest macro questions, send them in to Amanda, put them in the chat here, and we'll try to answer them at the end. And that would be Peter, because he is the brilliant macro mind. We're going to talk about this yield move and the dollar and kind of the relationship with equities, because that seems to have been breaking down a little bit. You've been a long-term silver bull. Guy and I put on a trade idea on April 2nd, long of the SLV, and that's working out really well. We're going to talk a little bit about that. And then why the dollar yen matters to you. Danny and Guy have been talking about it seemingly for a year. I know you write about it a lot in the book report, but we want to kind of bring it back to our viewer, our listener, for some of those who are not focused on FX and why this could be important to them for their U.S. Equity holdings here. I want to start with this chart, though, and let's talk about the relationship here, Peter. So this is the S&P 500. You see it in the white versus the U.S. dollar. That is the Dixie versus the 10-year yield. We are right now, I think, in the 10-year at 4.63. I think if I had asked you, let's say, you know, a month or two ago when the 10-year yield was at 4.1 or something like that, if we rallied 50 basis points, we're at 4.63, where do you think the S&P 500, you wouldn't have said 5,100 or higher, I bet, right?
Closer to 4,000 than 5,000.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about this relation. Break down this chart. You see the blue and you see the purple, and they basically look like the same thing. So that's yields and it's the dollar. And that makes sense to us. The one thing that doesn't make sense is what?
Right. The S&P for sure. I mean, with this chart, to start with the dollar and yields, you can even stretch this back to 2021 mm-hmm. when Jay Powell at the June FOMC meeting said, we're now thinking about tapering QE. Mm-hmm. That was sort of the beginning of, okay, there's a tightening cycle ahead mm-hmm. and the dollar just went on fire. Mm-hmm. And then ironically—
Let's pull up the Dixie. So let's do it one by one. Let's go back to 2021. It'll be interesting to see, you know, that move.
Yeah, the Dixie about. Right around then was about 90 and in June 2021. Mm-hmm. And then the dollar index topped out in October, November 2022, just as the Fed ended their last 75 basis point mm-hmm. rate hike. And the market started to believe that they were going to lower the cadence of rate increases. So you can see around that's the summer of 2021, that was the bottom in the dollar, June exactly. It was really with the day of that meeting or the day after that meeting. But it's showing you that the dollar relationship with the Dixie, and the Dixie is very heavy yen, euro, yep. pound. Dollar has not traded as well against like the Mexican peso and some other currencies, but at least the big developed country currencies, it's traded extraordinarily well, really mimicking interest rates. I mean, the European Central Bank cannot wait to cut interest rates, yeah. and they likely will do that in June. The mystery is why the yen is so weak, as they are tightening policy in their own itsy-bitsy way.
Very itsy-bitsy. And what, 10 basis points?
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And make do so again. But the gap between U.S. rates and Japanese rates are so wide that the Bank of Japan is going to have to do more if they're going to want to stop this yen rise. Now, why the S&P is trading so well, I want to call it a delayed reaction mm-hmm. rather than assuming that it's not going to react. Because this rise in interest rates is reminding us all that higher for longer is real. Now, when I say real, real in a sense that it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. The Fed's not, we're not seeing zero rates again anytime soon, or even if our in our lifetime. But real in the sense of the negative economic impact it has on a daily basis. I say on a daily basis because every day somebody's loan is coming due.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody's 3% loan that they priced in 2020, 2021 is repricing between 8 and 10% mm-hmm. right now, or even in double digits, depending on what kind of credit you are.
Mm-hmm.
And I was out for dinner with a real estate guy last night, and there's just the train keeps coming down the tracks towards them, mm-hmm. the longer rates stay high. So this stock move, I think, is sort of breathing hope that, okay, the economy's good. That's why rates are up. Therefore, we can tolerate higher rates. Mm-hmm. Earnings are rising. We can tolerate higher rates. But higher rates will then flow back to having a negative impact on economic activity. So, and multiples. I mean, the hardest thing to do if you're an investor in stocks is trying to figure out what should the right PE ratio be.
Yeah.
But there's one thing that I've learned doing this long enough. The higher rates are, the lower your multiple should be.
100%.
And all we've seen is this persistent bid in P multiple in the face of higher rates.
All right, but you know what's different this time? And I'm kind of playing a little bit of a devil's advocate here. What's different this time is that Microsoft and Apple and you know all the names, right? Like they make up a disproportionate amount of the S&P 500 weighting and a disproportionate amount of the actual earnings and then thus the earnings growth, right? And so therefore the multiple has been skewed towards Microsoft going from 27 times a year and a half ago going to 35 times, right? And even Apple, which is actually expected to have, you know, low single digits earnings growth that could actually be negative. If you saw the headline today that Apple's expected to have, you know, 10% lower iPhone shipments in Q1, I'm sure Q2 is going to be kind of weak too. So all of a sudden, if you were to get those big names to start decelerating in a meaningful manner or have margin pressure because of, you know, higher yields, dollar, you know, like they all sell a lot outside the US, all that expected 12% earnings growth for the S&P 500 is going to be at 6% pretty soon, right? And then at that point, you tell me, if the S&P is still at 5,100, you're going to be trading at 25 times. And I don't just understand what the condition for that would be.
Well, one thing that we've talked about, because the argument for sustaining and creating those very high multiples for those names is, well, those companies are immune to the higher rate cycle because they have this great balance sheet and they actually benefit because they have all this cash and they higher interest income and so on. And something that we've talked about in the past is that, yeah, okay, in itself, they're in good shape, but they sell to the rest of us.
Yep.
They are dependent on the buying habits of, well, Apple specifically. Does someone want to spend $1,300 or $1,400 for a new phone? So the budgeting of that consumer, they're dependent on. Microsoft sells into enterprise, as we know, but even consumer, well, if enterprise slows down, there's going to be less demand for Microsoft.
All right. We're going to get to enterprise spending because I think that's really interesting. Today, we saw retail sales data for March that was decelerated meaningfully from February. And so again, like as far as the consumer is concerned, I think we're going to get a pretty good look at them as we get into earnings over the next couple of weeks. I did think there was some interesting commentary out of some of the money center banks on Friday. I know you track a lot of those conference calls pretty closely. It wasn't all rosy. You know what I mean? Again, I think these guys are trying to be cautiously optimistic. I want to go to the S&P futures here really quickly, Peter, because this is one that I think is kind of interesting to me. It feels heavy. You know, we're down about 2.5% or so from the all-time highs that were just made earlier this month. Last week on the Monday market call, we detailed a trade idea in the E-mini futures. And, you know, at the time they were trading, I want to say 52.53. And what we were using was a really tight stop, Peter, 52.70. I know that in your past life, you traded a bit of the futures. One of the things that, you know, one of the first products I traded back in the late 90s was futures, a guy I worked for all day long. He was just, you know, selling, using stops, setting targets, downside stops, you know what I mean? All that sort of stuff. So like some of these levels and the way in which you place these stops are embedded in my brain and the whole idea of kind of lowering your stop and the like here. So 52.53 last Monday when we were doing this program, we were going to use a tight stop 52.70, which is the day high, I think it was. And we're targeting a move back to 51.15. All right, let's pull up today's chart of the S&P futures here, we're sitting right on that 50-day. Okay, so we've gotten to basically that target. We were saying 51.15 or so. We bounce a little bit from there. You know, here's when you want to just keep moving that stop down here. And now I really do want to play for a material break of that 50-day. That's not something we've had in a while. Peter, you look at technicals, okay? I know that you like a lot of different inputs. You start with a macro view, you work top down, you do a lot of bottoms up work. How important are technicals to you? When we throw these E-mini futures chart up here and I talk about these levels and I talk about, you know, the rolling over, sitting on the 50-day, you say to yourself, there's a lot of room between that 200-day. I think you mentioned this on the book report a few weeks ago, is the distance between where the S&P was trading and that 200-day was about 12%. It got to that level last July. And what did we have? Right. 11% peak to drop decline.
Exactly. As you can see, we and which traded down into the lows of October, November. Yeah. I think there are obviously a multitude of things that you can look at to determine the extension of a move. Mm-hmm. I think that was an effective one because we really haven't busted out from that. Yeah. I think when you see a parabolic move, which we did see a lot in mid-March, well, for a lot of those stocks, those were the highs.
Yeah.
That NVIDIA reversal day, that was the
March
high.
8th, yeah.
Super Micro, that was the high. Abercrombie and Fitch, that was the high.
Yeah.
That's one chart pattern that I'm comfortable knowing how that eventually ends.
Yeah.
Now, where it first goes before it reverses, who knows? But when you start to go vertical, you know you're pulling forward years of potential earnings growth. Now, when I look at a chart like this, to your question, for me, I look at it as perspective. It more than me trying to say, okay, what does this chart tell me on things that are going to happen from here? Because I'm not necessarily a good viewer of a chart to determine what's going to happen. I like to look at it for perspective. This tells me that the market is on the cusp of potentially something more. Mm-hmm. And then you think, okay, then you ask yourself, what will make it hold? What will make it break?
Mm-hmm.
And thankfully, a couple of things. Well, you have this rate move that can answer that question. But then you have earnings that can answer that question, which we're obviously right in the middle of the process getting underway. And I just think that this rate move is enough to tip that over. Trading at the multiple we're trading at, I just don't think is sustainable with the 10-year yield getting closer to 5% again.
Well,
and the dollar strength too, because the dollar strength also is a constricting of monetary and financial conditions.
Yep.
That could also impact earnings itself.
Well, so here's a one-year chart of the Dixie, okay? And you just kind of mentioned, you know, what it's exposed to. And I want to see if they can make this versus the S&P 500, because if you go back and you look at, you know, again, you know, that move in the Dixie up to 107 corresponded with the move in the 10-year yield up to 5%. That was the prior chart. But, you know, the S&P was acting inversely to that, okay? So here we are. We have this move. You could look at this and say on a one-year basis, it's, you know, it's range bound. You know what I mean? Like, you know, and it very well maybe, but if rates are going to 5%, this thing's going at least to 107. And you tell me the kind of headwind that is to U.S. multinational earnings. And so what I'm most interested in as I think about earnings season, Peter, is getting a sense for just what the sort of visibility a lot of these companies that have overseas exposure to. And again, our economy, the domestic stuff seems to be going just fine, right? It really is though. And maybe, you know, overseas and a lot of the places that we sell into are okay, ex-China, and we'll talk about that in a second. But, you know, the dollar strength is going to lessen that earnings exposure, you know what I mean, from overseas. So thoughts on that, because do you agree that that's going to be an interesting theme to really keep track of throughout earnings season?
Definitely. I mean, you look at the Dixie, the highs in October, November coincided with the lows
41.50
in the
S&P. And here
right.
we are at 51.50.
Exactly. Yeah. So the interesting thing is the dollar will most affect tech companies because they have the most international exposure. So if you want to, if Wall Street wants to play the game of you're going to beat estimates by 2 cents or 10 cents or 5 cents or whatever, a lot of that sort of variable is dependent on where the dollar goes because of the outsized exposure that these businesses have to Europe, to Asia, to the yen, to the pound, to the euro. So I think this is a big deal. And a lot of these big companies do hedge, but they never seem to hedge well enough. And it's impossible when you're in so many countries to hedge all your currency exposure.
Yeah.
So it's a big deal. And look, the earnings we've seen so far, and I always say every earnings season, I guarantee 75% of companies, give or take, are going to beat earnings estimates.
Yeah.
It's just like one of the laws of nature that always seems to come through on Wall Street. But look at the earnings we've seen so far and the responses. The banks we saw, not pretty.
Yeah.
CarMax, an early reporter. Fastenal, an early reporter. There are holes out there. And you mentioned the strong economy. To me, the economy is much more mixed. There are parts that are strong. Mm-hmm. The boomers are going on cruises like there's no tomorrow, and they're spending on whatever they want to spend on like there's no tomorrow. But the lower income consumer, the middle income consumer,
there's a lot of trade down.
There's stress.
Yeah,
you look. I was hoping that we were maybe seeing the beginning signs of a bottoming in manufacturing, and then the New York Manufacturing Index prints minus 14. So that tells me, well, maybe not so fast. There's so many mixed pieces to the economy, even housing, the pace of transactions, the lowest level in almost 30 years.
Yeah.
And builds are doing better.
So you're saying
but
the long and variable lags of tighter monetary policy are starting to kick in, because that was the big thing for 2023. And, you know, so many people in late October of 2022 were convinced we're going to have a recession, that the rate hikes and the aggressive pace of them were going to slow the economy down. It didn't happen. All right. So we had a lot of fiscal stimulus. You know what I mean? There was monetary stimulus that was put back in during the SVB sort of situation or whatever. But, you know, it's interesting, Peter, that the Fed, you know, from mid-December when the stock market really took off after that Fed presser, and they were expecting GDP growth in 2024, 1.4%, and they revised it higher within, what, 3 or 4 months to 2.1% at the March meeting or so. So the economy keeps chugging along, whether it's deficit spending, whether it's stimulus, whether it's, you know, whatever the hell it is, it just seems to keep working. Sooner or later, it's going to slow down. And the whole point about the stock market, it should start to anticipate that, right? And that's one of the reasons why I think the earnings guidance that we get in the next few weeks is going to be really important to the next move in the S&P 500.
Well, two things, both in terms of the discounting mechanism that we grew up on, being taught, pounded in our head, stock markets, this discounting mechanism, blah, blah, blah. And I found that that has become less and less so, and that the stock market has been more of a discounting mechanism on monetary policy.
Yeah.
You know, because we showed
as monetary policy has become more ever present in the economic landscape, because in the late 90s, there was some intervention. It was long-term capital. There were some things or whatever. They seemed kind of like blips. And when you think about what the interventions were, they weren't particularly large. You know what I mean? In dollar terms, now the markets are bigger, the economy is bigger, all that sort of stuff. But
as they become more dominant.
Yeah.
Because also if you take a step back, the stock market, as I mentioned, October 2022, not only did the Dixie peak, the stocks bottomed, but as I said, one of the reasons was because the market started to say, okay, the worst of the Fed increases are behind us in terms of the pace. Mm-hmm. Yes, they continued to hike, but that was the last 75 basis point cut. So there was like light at the end of the tunnel with respect to that monetary tightening. Here, if a stock market investor that always responds to the Fed's going to cut and save me, well, now you're thinking, well, they're going to taper QT fairly soon is what they told us, even though it's much more nuanced with that too, because they can extend out QT.
Yeah.
So even while they may slow the monthly pace, it may last longer. But the market's saying, okay, I need to own stocks ahead of the tapering of QT. I need to own stocks ahead of, well, the Fed still wants to cut. John Williams told us they want to cut. Jay Powell himself told us he wants to cut. So the Fed's going to save us.
Yeah.
And I think that's why we're trading at 20, 21 times earnings.
Yeah, but that just seems, you know, it's getting to a point where it's getting a little silly. You know, the whole idea of the Fed put. If the Fed starts lowering interest rates because things, basically the policy is too tight and the economy starts to slow, I mean, there might be this knock-on effect where it just really inflates some of the things, you know what I mean, that they were meant to, you know, I mean, we've had this discussion. So,
or it may not work.
Yeah.
They started cutting in, Bernanke first cut in 07.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. In that August, wasn't a good time to buy stocks.
Yeah. Yeah.
Greenspan started to cut, I think it was January 2020.
Yeah.
So this might be the longest pause, though,
that we have, right, between basically the last rate hike and what will be the first rate cut whenever it happens. Is that fair? I think we're kind of getting there or so. All right, let's just say hypothetically, this was like a play in the old playbook. Let's say there was something really kind of nasty happening geopolitically. The Fed used to like be on the ready to cut interest rates in that environment. If they were to do that right now, it could quite possibly be the worst thing, because one of the things we learned post COVID and obviously the Russian invasion of Ukraine is that, supply chain disruption is inflationary, right? Reshoring, all this stuff, and it's going on all the time, is inflationary. We've had sticky wage growth, right? Like that is, once it gets embedded, right? That's just a thing. So I don't know if cutting interest rates is the thing to do. All right.
I agree. And that is but market participants have been trained to believe that is the magic elixir. This time, because of inflation, the Fed's hands are really, really tied. So relying on the Fed to save your investment, I think, is a very dangerous assumption.
Yeah. Well, listen, at this point, I mean, if you remain like overweight U.S. stocks, you know what I mean? And you're overweight, I guess, some of the biggest names, you could kind of make the argument, well, I really believe that generative AI is going to be this gift that keeps on giving, first in the names that have been most exposed to it. Let's call it Microsoft, NVIDIA, and a handful of other names. But then it's going to start seeping its way into other industries, right? It's going to make them more productive. It's going to, this, that, or whatever. But again, we know that there's kind of like hype cycles and these things go in waves and they're going to move, that we haven't had that. I really thought we were on the precipice of that July into late October. I don't think I was pressing the lows in late October, but clearly once we got to like 5,000, I was like, enough is enough already. I think it's really important what you mentioned is that a lot of these names have been going sideways for the last month or so. And that's really important as we get into earnings season. I want to make one last point about the S&P 500. Maybe they can pull the futures up again. There was a gap on February 22nd. It was the day after NVIDIA's earnings. I was scratching my head based on the quarter and the guidance that they gave that the stock was up as much as it was, Peter.
$2 billion raise.
That's right. And so here we are, that gap is basically back to, maybe they can squeeze it in here a little bit. 5,000 is kind of the level here. And when you do the math on 150 points down to 5,000, it's another few percent or so. That would be a 5.5% peak to trough decline. And then things could really start to get interesting. Basically, might there be a disappointment in some of the bigger, Apple's disappointment's already priced in. So if it came from Microsoft, Amazon, Meta, Google, I think it's kind of like people like, all right, we might have one really crappy quarter, one more, one more or so. So again, if there's any big problems in any of those, S&P is going through that 50-day, people. And then, that 200-day is probably going to work its way, back, above 4,800 in the not so distant future. If you had a 5,250 down to 4,800, okay, then that's probably a decent level if you love some of those themes. All right, before we move on to some other stuff, Peter, I want to talk about the yen. And will you break it down in a very succinct fashion why, if you are just paying attention to this now, it seems like in every program on CNBC, people are talking about it on the hour. You've been writing about this for longer than a year, because we had the first test of 150, right, about a year ago or so, and it came back. And then people were making the same warning again as it got back to 150. But now it's at what, 153 or so?
154.
Or 154. All right. So talk to us, if you are a U.S. equity investor, why is this important to you? And if people have been warning, well, they said at 150, things are going to go haywire. They didn't. 151, 152. Here we are at 154.
There are a couple of things on how its movements, the JGB movements, mm-hmm. the actions of the BOJ mm-hmm. sort of flew through the global economy. With respect to the yen, Japan is the largest foreign holder of US treasuries. So the weaker yen causes a problem because they also are one of the largest importers of energy. Mm-hmm. The weaker the yen gets, the more inflation they import, the higher costs to import oil, mm-hmm. which they use dollars to pay for. Mm-hmm. So what happens when the yen weakens, oil prices are rising, the Japanese potentially could be selling treasuries. Mm-hmm. So a lot of this treasury sell-off, we're not going to know yet, but it could be the Japanese that are selling US treasuries mm-hmm. because of the weakness in the yen, because of the rising price of oil. You can actually chart the yen and the price of oil, and they pretty much follow each other mm-hmm. in the terms of the higher the yen level, technically, the weaker it is. But the higher oil prices go, the weaker the yen goes, the more possibility that they have to sell U.S. treasuries. So that's sort of the flow through. Mm-hmm. Also, we're all in this bond. It used to be a bubble, but now it's this bond unwind together. So what the BOJ did, the ECB, the BOE, the Fed, all of their monetary policy initiatives sort of mimicked each other, and all the bond moves sort of mimicked each other. So now you're having a major sell-off in the long end of the Japanese JGB market, which also flows to through to the action in the U.S. Treasury market and the back end of long-term yields in Europe. So I credit the rise in the 10-year yield from last summer when it was about 3.85 to 5% to when the BOJ said we're widening yield curve control from 50 basis points to one. Within days, the U.S. Treasury market started to sell off. That coincided with that rise to 5%. So what happens there affects what happens here. And I think that's why it's so important to watch the yen move, because it does correlate to U.S. Treasury yields.
Yeah. All right. So let's pull up the U.S. Treasury, the 10-year yield again here for 1 year chart. And this is really interesting. I just want to kind of give people get your sense. And all right. So look at that move. Let's call it late July, Peter, from like 385, that kind of level.
Yeah, that's when the BOJ widened yield curve.
So, and then we get, it took, you know, one, two, three, you know, about 3.5 months to get to that 5% level. Okay. We're kind of on that same pace right here from the same. So what happens next? I'm just going to tell you in October, and I know you're buddies with him, and I think the world of his commentary. Rick Santelli came on Fast Money to the day of the high. And this video got trending. Like, trust me, like you might have been on, I think you were on that week a little bit, and we might have asked you about this. And he didn't say it's happening tomorrow or next week or next year or anything like that. But he said treasury yields could rise precipitously in the years to come. And I think he said 10, 12, 13% or something like that. That was it. That was the high. And I'm only bringing that up. That's not a prediction that he was making near term. He could still be right. Right. But like when, if people were looking for a contrarian signal, that might've been it. Right. And so here we are now. What changes in what scenario? Let's just say we keep going up 7-8 basis points a day for the next few weeks or so, and we get back to 5%. What is the thing that would take it back from 5% back to 4% the way it happened in the fall?
It's a great question, and you wonder, you know, the factors that are both influencing it up and what can temper it on the downside.
Yeah,
because I argue that, you know, there's a belief in the market that if the Fed cuts, well, that'll tame yields across the yield curve. But I argue if the Fed cuts, but the long end is not satisfied that the inflation war has been won, then long rates actually can continue to go higher, even if the Fed cuts short-term interest rates. What can temper it is you really need to see a downshift further in these inflation numbers. I know we talked a lot about the move to 5% on the upside and the whole conversation about excessive treasury supply. Dominated the conversation. And then when yields fell from 5 to 4, that conversation sort of went away. That conversation is still here, but the budget deficit won't be sort of addressed or dealt with on both sides until you get to like 5.5 or 6, because only Washington only reacts in a crisis, and a 5.5% or 6% would be quite the sticker shock. Unfortunately, you have to get there in order to create the urgency to say, okay, we have to start paying attention to spending levels and so on. But I think in the immediate term, to answer your question exactly, we need to see a few months of a downshift in inflation. But unfortunately, at best, we're going to see sort of a flatlining at current levels. So it will be interesting to see when the Fed tapers QT, how that sort of mixes in with the action, because they're essentially selling less, so taking their foot off the pedal, you know, off the brake a bit on in terms of how they respond to the treasury market. But you know, again, the yen weakness leads to JGB selling. You have and a major macro event happened when we froze half of Russia's central bank reserves, because all these foreign holders of our treasury said, I don't want to own so many, I want to own more gold, and I don't want to own so many treasuries. And I don't see that trend changing anytime soon either.
Yeah. So let's talk about gold here. I know you've been a longtime bull, silver, longtime bull there. Silver's lag, gold. Carter Braxton Worth of Worth Charting had on his site over the weekend, I think starting on Friday, he was showing like the 27-year return of the S&P versus gold. They are flat versus each other, which is pretty fascinating. Okay. Like to me, it's pretty fascinating. And then how many charts look like that over the last, couple months or so? Well, NVIDIA, Bitcoin, and gold. I mean, that's it, right? And Supermicro or something like right. that. So, and then when you think of the reasons why, you know, institutions, central banks are buying this, like, I get it. I'm not a gold guy. Like, I'm not smart enough to figure it out, but I get why people want to own that. All right, look at this. That's Carter's chart there, which is pretty fascinating here. So he was calling it a dead heat. When you look at that, it's pretty, I mean, is that something, what does that speak to you a little bit about? Like,
well, and if you backed it up, you know, obviously in the 1980s and 1990s, stocks well outperformed gold.
Yeah.
In the 70s, gold well outperformed stocks.
Yeah.
So there are times to own gold, there are times not to own gold.
Yeah.
And what triggered back in 2000 when gold bottomed out at about 250, you know, obviously that was the peak of the tech bubble and the Fed started to experiment with 1% Fed funds rate, which at the time was like, wow, we're at 1%. And that's when central banks started to get very experimental with what they did.
Mm-hmm.
And we know what that led to in 2007, your colleague Danny Moses, of course, can talk about that.
Yeah.
And I think that we got so experimental that, you know, central banks have this very simplistic attitude of high rates, not good for the economy, low rates, good. And if low rates are good for the economy, even lower rates, even better for the economy. And, you know, Japanese and the Europeans said, well, zero is great for the economy. Negative has to be even better.
Yeah.
And all the QE. And so you started to experiment and gold has proven to be, I know people debate, is it really an inflation edge? Yeah. Is it not? But it is in the sense that it retains the purchasing power of what you want to buy.
Yeah.
Not that you're going to go to the gas station and use a gold coin to buy something. But if I had a dollar in year 2000 for when that chart started, mm-hmm. and I had a dollar gold coin, mm-hmm.
the purchasing power.
Yeah. So today I can buy a lot more gasoline at the station than I can with a dollar.
Yeah.
So I think it just proves that there is a purchasing power preservation aspect to gold.
Yeah.
Now, that's not the only asset. It could have been Bitcoin. It could have been. Look at the comic book, the Superman comic book just sold under auction.
Rolexes, everything.
For $6 million, if you include the buyer's
scarcity.
Premium.
I mean, but that's really what it comes down to. And you know, it's interesting.
It's a scarce asset. Yeah, Mickey Mantles is a scarce asset.
Yeah. But so let me ask you this, because, you know, like Bitcoin in particular, you know, there's a lot of bull cases for it. And the last remaining one, I think, is just the scarcity. And if you believe, you know, it's got similar properties to gold for all intents and purposes. But are you surprised at how many folks, and I think it has a lot to do with just the kind of rubber stamp from the spot Bitcoin ETFs, if you will, but a lot of really smart folks who are very dismissive of Bitcoin, not Jamie Dimon, he has not come around to it yet, are starting to think this is a real macro asset. Are you in that camp? Like, have you always been kind of Bitcoin curious, or I'm just curious, like, thoughts there?
So I don't think it yet has proven itself to be that.
Mm-hmm.
I think the genesis of Bitcoin was to be very similar to gold, mm-hmm. in this sort of anti-fiat currency, mm-hmm. infinite, can't be printed asset.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, Bitcoin has certainly been much more correlated to the NDX than it has been to the price of gold.
It is interesting to note that in that move that we've seen, you know, in the last few months where, you know, now gold is up 13% or something like that. You think of it in the global market cap, it's dwarfed the move that we've seen in Bitcoin that's up 50% or so in the last 6 months or so. So it is interesting that there's still people like institutions would much rather buy gold, obviously, than Bitcoin. Otherwise, you'd see Bitcoin going through the roof because there's lots of scarcity. And then they have this halving coming where the block rewards for mining a Bitcoin get cut in half, right? So making it more scarce and the like here. I'm just curious because it is, you know, given, you know, that we saw the sentiment around Bitcoin crescendo into the lows of the S&P and the NASDAQ, to your point, in late 2022, and there were massive frauds and there was all of this excess from MSTs, NFTs, and all this stuff that was going on in 21 into 22. I'm shocked that it's back. It made a new all-time high. But I get the reasons. If you were inclined to buy gold, then I would also be long some Bitcoin too. You know what I mean?
You do wonder though where Bitcoin would be if we didn't have all those ETF creations.
Yeah.
And all that buying.
Yeah, a lot of that needed to refill.
Yeah. It was needed to fill up those ETFs. But when you look at over the weekend, since Bitcoin was the only thing trading when Iran started to send their drones and missiles, Bitcoin traded down to 62,000.
Yeah.
There was no flight to safety in Bitcoin. The initial reaction was, I need to sell it.
Well, I think it is most definitely traded like that. You know what I mean? Because I think if you are, let's say, a weak-handed holder, let's say you're buying spot Bitcoin ETF because you like the idea of it, you know what I mean? It's going to look in your stock portfolio, you know what I mean, of ETFs and single names. It's going to look the same. You know what I'm saying? Because it's trading
look
as
at
an
today.
ETF. Yeah.
Bitcoin's trading down with the S&Ps and gold's trading up.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about today a little bit. So we opened the day and the headline was at Goldman Sachs, 28% year over year earnings growth surprise. You know, the thing was up 5.5% pre-market. It's given back, you know, half of those gains. You know, JP Morgan, that was down 6.5% on Friday, was up, I think, 2% or a little more at its highs, just bouncing a little bit. Now it's basically flat on the day. Everything has turned red. So all the, I guess if you were covering shorts in the opening because you got really bared up into the weekend, nothing's really changed other than the Israelis were able to thwart what seemed like a pretty big attack. They had some help from the U.S. and the U.K. I think that's also a positive sign. They weren't left at it alone. And then right. their defense
Even the
system.
Jordanians.
Yeah, I mean, which is crazy. I did not expect to see that name in there too. So this sort of price action, it's probably, what is it telling you as we get into earnings season here? Because, you know, it's like every morning, like there was also horrible story about Tesla cutting 10% of their workforce, senior leadership leaving, another one with Apple, you know, like it just seems like the negative stories about the names that we know keep coming. The positive stories, like a JP Morgan, for instance, seem like they're rolling over right now. Keep an eye on Eli Lilly, people. I know you think that these GLP-1s are this mega trend, and I believe they are. I'm a beneficiary of one. I've talked about on our pods and all this, but they're really concentrated trades. And it's not different than, let's say, a Bitcoin or an Nvidia or something like that. And if everybody wants to head for the door at the same time, you get what you had like on Friday in JP Morgan.
I think an important way of looking at this action now on the downside, and yeah, we can add Lilly to those parabolic charts that we talked about earlier, is market sentiment got hugely extreme as of a few weeks ago of a few things.
Yeah, well, you point, by the way, you pointed out in the book report.
The city panic euphoria got into euphoria mode, and according to their own statistical analysis, when it gets into euphoria, there's an 80% chance that the market will be down 12 months from now.
Yep.
Now, considering that the market usually goes up, for you to actually find a data point that points to the market going down on a statistically significant basis, you have to pay attention.
Yeah.
And then you throw in the investors' intelligence numbers, which I've been following since the early 90s, that when you see a bull bear spread of 40 plus, that's extreme. A few weeks ago, we got to 48. Mm-hmm. So this market was completely one-sided. That bull boat was standing room only. I don't even know if you could have actually, it was even standing room, the bull boat, as of a couple weeks ago. So then you throw in the rise in rates and the fundamentals that I know Carter likes to talk about, that we more focus on than he does. To me, the fundamentals between some of the disappointments with earnings, this rate move, this dollar strength, which I said earlier, is a financial condition tightener.
Yeah.
This was the perfect setup for a shaking of the tree.
Yeah. And you know, it's funny. Our friend Doug Cass at Seabreeze, who writes for Real Money, I mean, he's been talking about this kind of goofiness of this idea of the broadening out of the rally. And again, when you have euphoria in markets, you're going to have to some degree of broadening out because, you know, people can or get full up in different names. And I just want to pull up a Novo Nordisk. Okay. So this is NVO. And again, these guys, you know, with Lilly, they own this GLP-1 market. This is a $500 billion market cap company, or was at its highs when it gapped up in March on some good data about one of their drugs. Look at it, it's filled in the entire gap over the last month or so, right? And so I guess my point is like, so this is starting to lose momentum, right? It's through its 50-day moving average. when they go and report earnings. You know, people are already expecting a bang up result. That's not going to happen until May 2nd or so. Like, is this a good own? It's a very expensive stock. You know what I mean? Like, you know, it's a great story. But like, you want to buy things when they pull back, not when they're up in the euphoric sort of nature of that. Let's see what else we got here.
Wait, I'm going to swing back to silver for one quick
second. Oh, no, we got to do silver. Okay. Yeah. All right. So we talked about silver, the SLV in particular. You know, Guy is really great at this. Like you are. He had been pounding the table on gold. You get this parabolic move and you start to say, what's going to move next? We talked about the miners. We had a good trade on the miners on the market call a few weeks ago. And then we moved into silver and we caught it right before this move. It was still under 24 in the SLV here. Okay. So we got the move. We're going to update the options trade tomorrow on market call. So take a listen for that. You've been talking about silver for a long time. So is it its moment?
So silver is one of the unique commodities or / currencies, because it's a combination of both. Whereas gold, most of the use of gold is a central bank reserve, a coin, jewelry, teeth for some people.
Yeah.
Silver, half the demand is industrial, going into our iPhones, going into solar panels, going into other electronic products, wind turbines, EV batteries, whatever. Like, there's a secular demand story for silver on the industrial side. Mm-hmm. Then the other half is as a monetary metal, jewelry, tableware, the fork that you might use at a restaurant. And silver has always historically been sort of the little sibling of gold. Mm-hmm. And it's always been a high beta commodity. I mean, I think outside of natural gas and maybe soybeans, there aren't many more volatile commodities than silver. And finally, it got notice. It was like, it was just the most unpopular kid that is finally getting noticed. And if you just look at sort of a back of the envelope, sort of amateurish way of looking at silver relative to the price of gold, if you go back 50 years to the early 70s, when we went off the gold standard, the gold to silver ratio was about 60 times on average.
Okay.
If you put a 60 multiple on silver, you're talking about a 37-38 price per ounce of silver versus, you know, high 20s that we're at now.
Yeah.
And silver has been in this trading range for years.
Well, let's pull up this chart going back, let's call it 15 years or so. It really does feel like it's been for the last 4 years where gold was also in a pretty good base. You know what I mean? So it just broke out of this. If they want to show it, you know, going back, you'll see that spike in 2011. I remember that spike. It was crazy.
Yeah, it went to $50.
Yeah,
right.
It went to $50. I mean, you know, a breakout there, you do a measured move sort of argument and you get to, I think, some of the levels you're talking about in the 30s. So that makes some sense to me. All right, we're running against time. I want to hit some single stock names really quickly because we do have about 30 plus S&P 500 names reporting this week. The ones that I'm most focused on is Netflix on Thursday. And again, this is a company that has had two bang up quarters and guides, and the stock has been up, I think, at least 10% in each one, making new 52 week highs in each one. You know, this stock was also down 75% from its 2021 highs to its 2022 lows. I think this is the sort of name where sentiment is just too euphoric right now. And if you think about the volatility that they have had over the years in subscribers, you know what I mean? Like, this is one I'm really interested to see. If the guide is not good enough, I think you could see the stock down 10%, which might set a tone for a Meta, which has done the same thing. Amazon's done the same thing. You know, Google's been a bit of a laggard with two negative reports in the last two quarters, but it's still very near 52 week highs or so. So I like to look at names where expectations and sentiment is really good and see how they react, not too different than the JP Morgan. Does that make some sense to you?
Absolutely. Because we know a big part of a stock's rally is, yes, earnings may be rising as well, but it's also the multiple people want to put on it. And the more exciting story sounds, the more people get giddy about it, the higher multiple they're willing to pay.
Yeah, yeah.
But the beauty of earnings is it's always that needed gut check to say, was this move properly substantiated by our actual results?
Yeah.
Or was it people that got way ahead of themselves? And with Netflix, I'm actually interested to hear what they have to say about the end of the strike, because that put a pause, obviously, on new production. Does that push out some of their programming, which could impact their subscriber growth.
Anecdotally, I mean, or qualitatively, I guess, like when you turn on Netflix right now, I haven't seen anything new that I want to. They have the show Ripley that looks pretty good.
I watched The Gentleman.
Yeah. Okay.
But, is that Netflix? I think it was.
Yeah. But like my point is like I'm not being inundated with a bunch of stuff that, you know what I mean? So I think that's a good point.
Well, that's the thing about this business is you constantly have to come up with new content.
It's expensive. And now they're competing with, and they're competing with a lot of big fish right now.
That's extraordinarily expensive.
All right. One other name before we get to some questions here. American Express. This is interesting to me on Friday because, you know, the consumer, it has been something you and I spent a little time talking about at the start of the program, but, you know, the higher end consumer, there's been some volatility on that front. You know, you talked about the boomers before, but this is one that is interesting to me because the stock has come a long, just look at that chart. It's come a long way, right? And so back in the fall, you were pricing in a weakening higher end consumer. We were seeing stuff at a Dollar Tree and the like where they were talking about the trade down and everything. I mean, the sentiment was really bad towards the consumer. It seems to be the exact opposite way again right now.
I mean, you can literally put a chart of AXP versus the S&P.
Yeah.
And I say that not for a correlation perspective, but the customer of American Express is benefiting from the S&P.
Yeah.
Plus you have, we talked about the boomers who are enjoying their 5% interest income on their T-bills and money markets where they're using that income to travel and spend. You know, that's the crux of that American Express customer. So where the S&P 500 goes can literally determine the earnings of American Express when looking at over the next couple of years.
It is pretty fascinating, though, if they want to pull up a five-year chart. I mean, American Express doubled the performance of the S&P 500 off of the October lows. So when you get that
Yeah, the multiple went from 10 to 20.
That's right. And it just seemed a little bit silly there. So that's another name. So those two names I'm really focused on. All right, let's get to some questions here, Peter. We asked them for some really difficult macro questions. All right, let's hit one. Let me find a topic that we haven't gotten to. This is from Ian P. Hey guys, can you speak if mortgage rates will drop this year if the macro outlook improves and rates drop, hoping to refinance soon? Okay, so that seems like a Suze Orman question, but we'll take it, Peter. Like, give it to us here, because again, I just saw that the 30-year mortgage got back above 7 or got back to 7%. I know a lot of folks were hoping this was going to be going below 6, you know, 5, that sort of thing. We know that we have these supply-demand dynamics. Listen, if we see unemployment start to tick up again a little bit, the supply question the demand question might be less in question. Thoughts on that, though, because again, I know that that's obviously what you want to focus on. If we see the Fed funds coming down, people want to see mortgage rates come down.
Well, if the macro continues as is, mm-hmm. they're not going to come down.
Yeah.
I think the way that people, when I say people, those that are looking to buy a house that are struggling with this very sharp rise in the price of the home, and then you layer on the high cost of financing a home, that if someone needs to move, they need to move. Mm-hmm. But if someone wants to be in this house for a long time, if they have, just as we need a time horizon when it comes to the stock market, if you're going to make a long-term investment, you need to have that with a house.
Yeah.
If you're looking at a place that you're going to only live in for 2 to 3 years, don't buy it. If you think you're going to live there for 20 to 30 years, you suck up the 7% mortgage rate, because over time, hopefully the more income you make, the more you can actually pay down that mortgage.
Yeah.
And paying down a high-cost mortgage is essentially like buying a bond with your savings.
Yeah. Isn't it fascinating, though, that 2 years ago, people, I just heard, you know, lots of friends bragging about their 30-year below 3%, you know what I mean? And getting that sort of money for that sort of time period, thinking about the same thing. You're not going to be buying it down because that's pretty cheap
that
money.
That person is not exactly.
Yeah.
And they should not.
Yeah.
You should not expect any notable decline in mortgage rates. Can we go back to 4 and retest maybe? Yes.
Yeah.
But you're talking about 50 basis points in the scheme of a 7% plus mortgage rate. Yes, it makes a difference, but only tiny on the margin.
Yeah.
Make more of the decision of how long you're going to live in that house for, and do you really love it, and do you see yourself paying it down over time?
Yeah. All right. No doubt. All right. So this is from Gary Webb. Do you believe that passive investing will work in reverse, act as an accelerant if the broader market begins to slide to the downside. This is something Guy talks about a lot. You know, when you think about how exposed, you know, so many ETFs now are to some of the most popular names, as you know what they are, Apple and Microsoft and the like. And a lot of folks have said, hey, listen, it's been pretty good, right? Apple sold off, you know, 15% from its all-time highs, and the S&P was making new highs throughout the whole thing. Talk to me about that as an accelerant to the downside, because we're also, I think Liz Young told us this morning on the tape, we're 289 days without a 2% down day in the S&P 500. It seems like it has not acted as an accelerant to this point. If anything, it's acted as like, you know what I mean?
Support.
Yeah. Some,
yeah. So, yeah. I think as human nature never changes, it could.
Yeah.
Now, not early on in a sell-off. The accelerant takes place because that passive is, a lot of it is retail. And what does retail mostly do? They get more nervous after a sell-off rather than at the beginning of one, right? They're not calling their financial advisor because the S&P is at 5,100 down from 5,200 saying, what should I do? But if all of a sudden we're trading at 4,800, they start calling and ask that question. So I do believe that while it doesn't lead to retail calling up their advisor saying, I need to get out of the S&P, all they have to do is buy less. You know, if they're putting money into the market,
dollar cost averaging, which
if they say, you know what?
Yeah.
You know what? This 5% money market doesn't seem so bad.
That's right.
So instead of putting in 100% of my paycheck, I'm only going to put in 50% or 25%. So on the margin, that lack of passive buying can also technically be an accelerant, just like company stock buybacks.
Yep.
The amount of stock that big banks bought in 2005 and 2006, if they didn't buy all that stock, maybe they wouldn't have needed the bailout from the government. So just because you're buying stock as a passive bid doesn't mean you can keep your stock market or individual stock elevated forever. The law of supply and demand and fundamentals actually do start to matter. So to his point, yes, it could be an accelerant, but not at the beginning of a sell-off. Later on, possibly in one.
Yeah. All right. Here's one from Griffin Keenan. Any less talked about liquidity measures Dan and or Peter would recommend keeping an eye on? So less talked about liquidity measures other than Fed balance sheet, M2, weekly reserve balances. Thank you so much.
It's a good question. That's tough. I mean, I look at sort of measures that measure liquidity. And it can be even because liquidity is not always the depth of a bid and offer. It's also the risk on risk aversion mentality of the investor. Because Microsoft can have an air pocket if people just want to step back. So it could be a liquid stock, but have moments of illiquidity.
Yeah.
So I think it's important to watch sentiment, as we discussed, and also watch put call ratios, watch credit spreads. Because that's also an important thing to pay attention to.
I got one for you. Okay. And this is from Jay Sloan. Jay is a avid watcher. And by the way, Jay, I just got the book today. He sent me Lynn Alden's book. I think it's called Broken Market.
Yeah, brand new book.
Yeah. So thank you for that. Shout out to Jay. We owe you a water bottle, a market call water bottle for that one. With all the uncertainty and risk in markets today, how is the junk bond spread so low?
So I think we have to look at this in two ways. The absolute yield is not so low. The spread certainly is very low. I think the higher yield is certainly mimicking the yield curve, where the cost of credit for high yield is now 8%-ish. The triple C category is into the teens. So if you're a business that needs to borrow money and you're a junk rated company, you're not waking up excited because your credit spread is tight. You're waking up, oh boy, how am I going to pay this 9% interest rate? Now, in terms of the spread being tight, I think that's just part of the whole risk on environment that we've seen since the October lows. I think it's also the belief that, well, rates have peaked and the Fed is going to be cutting interest rates as part of that. And I need to be long credit going into a rate cutting cycle. So I think that is also keeping things relatively tight. But you get a couple more days like we saw Friday and today, and those spreads are going to widen right back out
again.
Well,
this is getting nasty today a little bit, especially considering where we started in the pre-market here. You know, so this is down, you know, I see the S&P futures down, you know, 93 basis points, 48. Think about that, Peter. We haven't had too many days that have had 100 handle moves in the S&P 500. All right, last question. This is from Dan S. Nathan, that'd be me. NVIDIA. All right, so let's. So we haven't mentioned, I don't think, NVIDIA all day. We can take 2 minutes on this, then I promise you, people, we're going to get out of here. But so, you know, this is one where, again, you know, it did test those March 8 highs. It had a 10% intraday reversal. Guy's been talking about it a little bit, and to him, that he's just kind of, you know, kind of bet his move on this cycle that was a moment. Okay, bookmarked it. Footmoded, whatever you want to do. So here we are right now, and they're not going to report until late May. All right. But we're going to get all their customers, and we're going to all their competitors. Okay. And I'm expecting that a bunch of them are not going to be particularly great. All right. So here, this company right now, earnings are expected to be up 90% year over year. Is that what you see? Okay. The stock is up 80% year over year. Sales expected to be up 80% year over year. Now, both of those are expected to decelerate next fiscal year to about 22%. Margins, this has been a big part of that story, right? Are expected to decelerate. They just guided this quarter to 77% gross margin, their highest ever. Okay. Next calendar year or next fiscal year, they're expected to decelerate a few points or so. So I say to myself, is all the good news in the stock here, Peter? Because people are going to be telling me, dude, it's trading at 35 times this year, 19 and a half times sales, which is a lot. Next year, 29 times, 16 times sales.
So I have a problem with people that analyze a stock on 1 year of earnings.
Yeah.
A stock is supposed to be a discounting mechanism for many, many years of future cash flows.
Mm-hmm.
And if you assume that NVIDIA's profit margins, gross margin, will stay at 77%, mm-hmm. well, then you can have some more visibility to what their earnings are going to be, and you can sustain a certain level of growth.
Mm-hmm.
But 77% is mathematically impossible to sustain,
mm-hmm.
especially when their current biggest customers are looking to be their competitors.
Mm-hmm.
Who is going to replace Google's demand for NVIDIA's chips? Mm-hmm. Who's going to replace when they develop it themselves?
Mm-hmm. Not
when
the Meta Chinese.
The amount of chips that they've been buying, yeah. you can't replace that and sustain a 77% gross margin rate. That's why for a situation like this, I would much rather value a company on price to sales.
Yeah.
Because it takes out what will likely be massive variability and volatility in your gross margin. Mm-hmm. And at 20 times, that is rich for a very cyclical business.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, that way, hold on, I want to push back for a second, but the AI, the Gen AI bulls will tell you this is not cyclical. This is a secular trend that's going to be around. You know, Sam Altman wanted to raise $7 trillion with a T to buy GPUs. You know what I mean? Like, so that coincided also with some of those sentiment readings that you were talking about with the stock market, which makes sense because NVIDIA went from a $300 billion market cap company to a $2.3 trillion market cap company in 2 years.
Well, that's technology runs in waves.
Yeah.
And the waves, the upward wave is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
But the real beneficiary of AI, I believe, will be the users of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tool, just like software is.
Mm-hmm.
And every new iteration of software makes us more productive. Every new iPhone, while maybe we don't upgrade to the same extent as we once did, is better than the prior one. And it's very hard to sustain high levels of profitability outside of a couple of years in a very cyclical business. So I'm not saying that this party is ending. It could last a couple more years. I just think investors need to have eyes wide open when they buy what's... We lived through the late 90s.
Mm-hmm.
The Micron was the hottest stock in the mid to late 90s.
Nortel,
but as a semiconductor,
Qualcomm,
speaking of semis,
Qualcomm,
and Intel,
Qualcomm
too. Micron, everyone said, wow, the PC is really blowing up.
Yeah.
Windows 95, Dell and Gateway were selling PCs like it was going out of style, and Micron was selling the memory to that.
Yeah.
This is a major secular trend. You have to have memory if you're going to have a computer that wants to log on to the internet.
Yeah.
This is the greatest thing. And what did Micron turn out to be? An extraordinarily volatile stock that after its initial excitement
cyclical.
Never attained that same sort of multiple because people realized, at the end of the day, it's a cyclical business, mm-hmm. and it's going to have its run. That's going to be extraordinary. Mm-hmm. But once that run starts to quiet down, it's a commodity like anything else.
Yeah. Well, I mean, GPUs will be a commodity once you get into the inference phase of these. I mean, like, it's just that, I mean, I get it, but you know, I get told I'm stupid every day for trying to point out how it's similar to what we saw 25 years ago. But again, all right, well, that was good, Peter. All right.
Thank you, Dan.
Listen, man, we covered a lot of ground here. I just thought that we had Peter in studio. We haven't talked to Peter in a while. I read him every day, so I feel like I talk to him. We do message and chat a bunch here. So if you haven't looked at the book report, check it out. You can find it online. You can subscribe. I really enjoy it, and I've been reading it for years. And Peter, we really appreciate your work. If you want to find more, I think you're on Bleakley Financial Group on the website there.
Yeah, bleakley.com.
Yeah, find out more about what Peter's doing over there. We appreciate you coming here, man.
Thanks, Dan. This was great. I love
it. Thanks, buddy. Yeah. Thanks, everyone, for being here. I'll be back tomorrow with Carter Braxton Worth. We'll see you then.